Harper Audio presents Thud by Terry Pratchett, performed by Stephen Briggs. The first thing Tack did, he wrote himself. The second thing Tack did, he wrote the laws. The third thing Tack did, he wrote the world. The fourth thing Tack did, he wrote a cave. The fifth thing Tack did, he wrote a geode, an egg of stone. And in the twilight of the mouth of the cave, the geode hatched, and the brothers were born. The first brother walked toward the light, and stood under the open sky. Thus he became too tall. He was the first man. He found no laws, and he was enlightened. The second brother walked toward the darkness, and stood under a roof of stone. Thus he achieved the correct height. He was the first dwarf. He found the laws Tack had written, and he was endarkened. But some of the living spirit of Tack was trapped in the broken stone egg, and it became the first troll, wandering the world, unbidden and unwanted, without soul or purpose, learning or understanding. Fearful of light and darkness, it shambles for ever in twilight, knowing nothing, learning nothing, creating nothing, being nothing. From Good Tack Gar, The Things Tack Wrote, translated Professor W. W. Wildblood, Ankh-Morpork, Unseen University Press, 8 Ankh-Morpork dollars. In the original, the last paragraph of the quoted text appears to have been added by a much later hand. Him who mountain crush, him know. Him who sun, him stop him know. Him who hammer, him break him know. Him who fire, him fear him know. Him who raise him head above him heart, him diamond. Translation of troll pictograms found carved on a basalt slab in the deepest level of the Ankh-Morpork treacle mines, in pig treacle measures estimated at 500,000 years old. Thud. That was the sound the heavy club made as it connected with the head. The body jerked and slumped back. And it was done. Unheard. Unseen. The perfect end. A perfect solution. A perfect story. But, as the dwarfs say, where there is trouble, you will always find a troll. The troll saw. It started out as a perfect day. It would soon enough be an imperfect one, he knew, but just for these few minutes it was possible to pretend that it wouldn't. Sam Vimes shaved himself. It was his daily act of defiance, a confirmation that he was, well, plain Sam Vimes. Admittedly, he shaved himself in a mansion, and while he did so, his butler read out bits from the Times, but they were just circumstances. It was still Sam Vimes looking back at him from the mirror. The day he saw the Duke of Ankh-Morpork in there would be a bad day. Duke was just a job description, that's all. "Most of the news is about the current dwarfish situation, sir," said Willikins, as Sam negotiated the tricky area under the nose. He still used his granddad's cutthroat razor. It was another anchor to reality. Besides, the steel was a lot better than the steel you got today. Sybil, who had a strange enthusiasm for modern gadgetry, kept on suggesting he get one of these new shavers, with a little magic imp inside that had its own scissors and did all the cutting very quickly. But Vimes had held out. If anyone was going to be using a blade near his face, it was going to be him. "Combe Valley, Combe Valley," he muttered to his reflection. "Anything new?" "Not as such, sir," said Willikins, turning back to the front page. "There is a report of that speech by Greg Hamcrusher. There was a disturbance afterwards, it says. Several dwarfs and trolls were wounded. Community leaders have appealed for calm." Vimes shook some lather off the blade. "Ha! I bet they have. Tell me, Willikins, did you fight much when you were a kid? Were you in a gang or anything?" "I was privileged to belong to the Shamlegger Street Rude Boys, sir," said the butler primly. "Really?" said Vimes, genuinely impressed. "They were pretty tough nuts, as I recall." "Thank you, sir," said Willikins smoothly. "I pride myself I used to give somewhat more than I got, if we needed to discuss the vexed area of turf issues with the young men from Rope Street. Stevedore's hooks were their weapon of choice, as I recall.
"And yours?" said Vimes, agog.
"A cap brim sewn with sharpened pennies, sir. An ever-present help in times of trouble."
"Ye gods, man! You could put someone's eye out with something like that."
"With care, sir, yes."
And here you stand now in your pinstriped trousers and butlering coat, shiny as schmaltz and fat as butter, Vimes thought, while he tied it up under the ears. And I'm a duke. How the world turns.
"And have you ever heard someone say, 'Let's have a disturbance'?" he said.
"Never, sir."
"Me neither. It only happens in newspapers."
Vimes glanced at the bandage on his arm. It had been quite disturbing, even so.
"Did it mention I took personal charge?" he said.
"No, sir, but it does say here that rival factions in the street outside were kept apart by the valiant efforts of the watch, sir."
"They actually used the word valiant," said Vimes.
"Indeed they did, sir."
"Well, good," Vimes conceded grumpily. "Do they record that two officers had to be taken to the Free Hospital, one of them quite badly hurt?"
"Unaccountably not, sir," said the butler.
"Ha! Typical. Oh, well, carry on."
Willikins coughed a butlery cough.
"You might wish to lower the razor for the next one, sir. I got into trouble with her ladyship about last week's little nick."
Vimes watched his image sigh and lowered the razor.
"All right, Willikins, tell me the worst."
Behind him the paper was professionally rustled. On this day in 1802, the painter Methodia Rascal woke up in the night because the sounds of warfare were coming from a drawer in his bedside table. Again. One little light illuminated the cellar, which was to say that it lent different textures to the darkness and divided shadow from darker shadow. The figures barely showed up at all. It was quite impossible with normal eyes to tell who was talking.
"This is not to be talked about. Do you understand? Not talked about. He's dead. This is dwarf business. It's not to come to the ears of the city watch. They have no place here. Do any of us want them down here? They do have dwarf officers. Ha! Dugza! Too much time in the sun. They're just short humans now. Do they think dwarf? And Vimes will dig and dig and wave the silly rags and tatters they call laws? Why should we allow such a violation? Besides, this is hardly a mystery. Only a troll could have done it, agreed? I said, are we agreed?"
"That is what happened," said a figure. The voice was thin and old, and, in truth, uncertain.
"Indeed, it was a troll," said another voice, almost the twin of that one, but with a little more assurance.
The subsequent pause was underlined by the ever-present sound of the pumps.
"It could only have been a troll," said the first voice. "Is it not said that behind every crime you will find the troll?"
There was a small crowd outside the watch-house in Pseudopolis Yard when Commander Sam Vimes arrived at work. It had been a fine sunny morning up until then. Now it was still sunny, but nothing like as fine. The crowd had placards. "Bloodsuckers out," Vimes read, and "No fangs." Faces turned toward him with a sullen, half-frightened defiance. He uttered a bad word under his breath, but only just. Otto Treacle, the Times iconographer, was standing nearby holding a sunshade and looking dejected. He caught Vimes' eye and trudged over.
"What's in this for you, Otto?" said Vimes. "Come to get a picture of a jolly good riot, have you?"
"It's news, Commander,"
said Otto, looking down at his very shiny shoes.
"Who tipped you off?"
"I just do the pictures, Commander," said Otto, looking up with a hurt expression. "Anyway, I couldn't tell you even if I knew, because of the freedom of the press."
"Freedom to pour oil on a flame, do you mean?" Vimes demanded.
"That's freedom for you," said Otto. "No one said it was nice."
"But, well, you're a vampire, too," said Vimes, waving a hand toward the protesters. "Do you like what's been stirred up?"
"It's still news, Commander," said Otto meekly.
Vimes glared at the crowd again. It was mostly human, There was one troll, although admittedly the troll had probably joined in on general principle, simply because something was happening. A vampire would need a masonry drill and a lot of patience before it could put a troll to any trouble. Still, there was one good thing, if you could call it that. This little sideshow took people's minds off Coombe Valley.
"It's strange they don't seem to mind you, Otto," he said, calming down a little.
"Well, I'm not official," said Otto. "I do not have the sword on the badge. I do not threaten. I am just a working stiff, and I make them laugh."
Vimes stared at the man. He's never thought about that before, but yes, little fussy Otto in his red-lined black opera cloak with pockets for all his gear, his shiny black shoes, his carefully cut widow's peak, and not least his ridiculous accent that grew thicker or thinner depending on whom he was talking to, did not look like a threat. He looked funny, a joke, a music hall vampire. It had never previously occurred to Vimes that, just possibly, the joke was on other people. Make them laugh, and they're not afraid. He nodded to Otto and went inside, where Sergeant Cheery Littlebottom was standing, on a box, at the high duty officer's desk, her chevrons all shiny and new on her sleeve. Vimes made a mental note to do something about the box. Some of the dwarf officers were getting sensitive about having to use it.
"I think we could do with a couple of lads standing outside, Cheery," he said. "Nothing provocative, just a little reminder to people that we keep the peace."
"I don't think we'll need that, Mr. Vimes," said the dwarf.
"I'm not interested in seeing a picture in the Times showing the Watch's first vampire recruit being mobbed by protesters, Corp."
"Sergeant," said Vimes severely.
"I thought you wouldn't be, sir," said Cheery. "So I asked Sergeant Angua to fetch her. They came in the back way half an hour ago. She's showing her the building. I think they're down in the locker room."
"You asked Angua to do it?" said Vimes, his heart sinking.
"Yes, sir," said Cheery, suddenly looking worried. Is there a problem?"
Vimes stared at her. "She's a good orderly officer," he thought. "I wish I had two more like her. And she deserved the promotion heavens knew, but," he reminded himself, "she's from Uberwald, isn't she? She should have remembered about the thing between them and werewolves. Maybe it's my fault. I tell them that all coppers are coppers."
"What?"
"Oh, no," he said. "Probably not." A vampire and a werewolf in one room, he thought, as he headed on up the stairs to his office. Well, they'll just have to deal with it, and that'll just be the first of our problems.
"And I took Mr. Pessimol up to the interview room," Cheery called after him.
Vimes stopped in mid-stair.
"Pessimol?" he said.
"The government inspector, sir," said Cheery. "The one you told me about."
"Oh, yes," thought Vimes. "The second of our problems." It was politics. Vimes could never get a handle on politics, which was full of traps for honest men. This one had been sprung last week in Lord Vetinari's office at the normal daily briefing.
"Ah, Vimes," said his lordship as Vimes entered. "So kind of you to come. Isn't it a beautiful day?"
Up until now, Vimes thought, when he spotted the two other people in the room.
"You wanted me, sir," he said, turning to Vetinari again. "There's a Silicon Anti-Defamation League march in Water Street, and I've got traffic backed up all the way to Leastgate."
"I'm sure it can wait, Commander."
"Yes, sir, that's the trouble, sir. That's what it's doing."
Vetinari waved a languid hand. "Full carts congesting the street, Vimes, is a sign of progress," he declared.
"Only in the figurative sense, sir," said Vimes.
"Well, at any rate, I'm sure your men can deal with it," said Vetinari, nodding to an empty chair. "You have so many of them now. Such an expense. Do sit down, Commander. Do you know Mr. John Smith?"
The other man at the table took the pipe out of his mouth and gave Vimes a smile of manic friendliness.
"I don't believe we have had the pleasure," he said, extending a hand.
It should not be possible to roll your W's, but John Smith managed it. Shake hands with a vampire, not bloody likely, Vimes thought, not even one wearing a badly hand-knitted pullover. He saluted instead.
"Pleased to meet you, sir," he said crisply, standing to attention.
It really was an awful garment, that pullover. It had a queasy zigzag pattern in many strange, unhappy colours. It looked like something knitted as a present by a colour-blind aunt, the sort of thing you wouldn't dare throw away in case the garbage collectors laughed at you and kicked your trash cans over.
Vimes, Mr. Smith is, Veterinari began, President of the Ankh-Morpork Mission of the Oberwald League of Temperance, said Vimes, and I believe the lady next to him to be Mrs. Doreen Winkings, Treasurer of Same. This is about having a vampire in the watch, isn't it, sir? Again. Yes, Vimes, it is, said Veterinari. And yes, it is again. Shall we all be seated, Vimes? There was no escape, Vimes knew, as he sagged resentfully into a chair, and this time he was going to lose. Veterinari had cornered him. Vimes knew all the arguments for having pyres who got class, education, a von in front of their name. There's 100 better things for them to be doing than walking the streets as a cop. What do you want me to do, force them to join the force? Wouldn't they be offered officer rank? Said John Smith. There was sweat on his face, and his permanent smile was manic. Rumour had it that he was finding the pledge very hard going. No, everyone starts on the street, said Vimes. That wasn't entirely true, but the question had offended him. And on the night watch, too. Good training. The best there is. A week of rainy nights, with the mists coming up, and the water trickling down your neck, and odd noises in the shadows. Well, that's when we find out if we've got a real copper. He knew it as soon as he said it. He'd walked right into it. They must have found a candidate. "Well, that is good news," said Mrs. Winkings, leaning back. Vimes wanted to shake her and shout, "You're not a vampire, Doreen. You're married to one, yes, but he didn't become one until a time when it is beyond human imagining that he could possibly have wanted to bite you. All the real Black Ribboners try to act normal and unobtrusive. No flowing cloaks, no sucking, and definitely no ripping the underwired nightdresses off young ladies. Everyone knows John Not a Vampire at All Smith used to be Count Vargo St. Gruet von Villainous, but now he smokes a pipe and wears those horrible woollen sweaters, and he collects bananas and makes models of human organs out of matchsticks because he thinks hobbies make you more human. But you, Doreen, you were born in Cockbill Street. Your mum was a washerwoman. No one would ever rip your nightdress off, not without a crane. But you're so into this, right? It's a damned hobby. You try to look more like vampires than vampires do. Incidentally, those fake pointy teeth rattle when you talk. Vimes? Huh? Vimes became aware that people had been speaking. Mr. Smith has some good news, said Veterinari.
Indeed, yes, said John Smith, beaming manically. "We have a recruit for you, Commander. A vampire who wants to be in the watch."
"And, of course, the knight will not present a problem," said Doreen triumphantly. "We are the knight." "Are you trying to tell me that I must—" Vimes began. Veterinari cut in quickly. "Oh, no, Commander, we all fully respect your autonomy as head of the watch. Clearly you must hire whomsoever you think fit. All I ask is that the candidate is interviewed in a spirit of fairness." "Yeah, right," thought Vimes. "And politics with Oberwald will become just that bit easier, won't it, if you can say you even have a black ribboner in the watch? And if I turn this man down, I'll have to explain why. And I just don't like vampires, okay, probably won't do." "Of course," he said. "Send him along." "He is, in fact, she," said Lord Veterinari. He glanced down at his paperwork. "Salacia della Resista Amanita Trigestatra Zeldana Malefi..." He paused, turned over several pages, and said, "I think we can skip some of these, but the end von Humperdinck. She is 51, but," he added quickly before Vimes could seize on this revelation, "that is no age at all for a vampire. Oh, and she'd prefer to be known simply as Sally." The locker room wasn't big enough. Nothing like big enough. Sergeant Angwer tried not to inhale. A large hall, that was fine. The open air, even better. What she needed was room to breathe. More specifically, she needed room not to breathe vampire. Damn cheery. But she couldn't have refused. That would have looked bad.
All she could do was grin and bear it and fight down a pressing desire to rip out the girl's throat with her teeth. She must know she's doing it, she thought. They must know that they exude this air of effortless ease, confident in any company, at home everywhere, making everyone else feel second-class and awkward. Oh, my! Call me Sally, indeed. "Sorry about this," she said aloud, trying to force the hairs on the back of her neck not to rise. "It's a bit close in here," she coughed. "Anyway, this is it. Don't worry, it always smells like this in here. And don't bother to lock your locker, all the keys are the same, and anyway, most of the doors spring open if you hit the frame in the right way. Don't keep valuables in it, this place is too full of coppers. And don't get too upset when someone puts holy water or a wooden stake in there."
"Is that likely to happen?" said Sally.
"Not likely," said Angua, "certain. For instance, I used to find dog collars and bone-shaped biscuits in mine."
"Didn't you complain?"
"What? No, you don't complain," snapped Angua, wishing she could stop inhaling right now. Already she was sure her hair was a mess.
"But I thought the watch was—"
"Look, it's nothing to do with what you— what we are, okay?" said Angua. "If you were a dwarf, it'd be a pair of platform soles or a stepladder or something, although that doesn't happen so much these days. Mostly they try it on everyone. It's a copper thing, and then they'll watch what you do, you see? No one cares if you're a troll or a gnome or a zombie or a vampire. Much," she added to herself, "but don't let them believe you're a whiner or a snitch. And actually, the biscuits were pretty good, to tell you the truth. Ah, have you met Igor yet?"
"Many times," said Sally.
Angua forced a smile. "In Uberwald you met Igors all the time, especially if you were a vampire."
"The one here, though," she said.
"I don't think so."
Ah, that was a relief. Angua normally avoided Igor's laboratory, because the smells that emanated therefrom were either painfully chemical or horribly, suggestively organic, but now she'd snuff them up with relief. She headed to the door with slightly more speed than politeness required and knocked. It creaked open. Any door opened by an Igor would creak.
It was a knack.
"Hi, Igor," said Sally cheerfully. "Gimme six."
Angua left them chatting. Igors were naturally servile, vampires were naturally not. It was an ideal match. At least she could go and get some air now. The door opened.
"Mr. Pessimble, sir," said Cheery,
ushering in a man not much taller than she was into Vimes's office.
"And here's the office copy of the Times."
Mr. Pessimble was neat. In fact, he went beyond neat. He was a folding kind of person. His suit was cheap but very clean. His little boots sparkled. His hair gleamed, too, even more than the boots. It had a centre parting, and had been plastered down so severely that it looked as though it had been painted on his head. All the city's departments got inspected from time to time, Vetinari had said. There was no reason why the watch should be passed over, was there? It was, after all, a major drain on the city coffers. Vimes had pointed out that a drain was where things went to waste. Nevertheless, Vetinari had said. Just nevertheless. You couldn't argue with nevertheless. And the outcome was Mr. Pessimle walking toward Vimes. He twinkled as he walked. Vimes couldn't think of another way to describe it. Every move was, well, neat. Shovel, purse, and spectacles on a ribbon, I'll bet, he thought. Mr. Pessimle folded himself onto the chair in front of Vimes's desk and opened the clasps of his briefcase with two little snaps of doom. With some ceremony, he donned a pair of spectacles. They were on a black ribbon.
"My letter of accreditation from Lord Vetinari, Your Grace," he said, handing over a sheet of paper.
"Thank you, Mr. A.E. Pessimle," said Vimes, glancing at it and putting it on one side. "And how can we help you?"
"It's Commander Vimes when I'm at work, by the way."
"I will need an office, Your Grace, and an oversight of all your paperwork. As you know, I am tasked to give His Lordship a complete overview and cost-benefit analysis of the watch, with any suggestions for improvement in every aspect of its activities. Your cooperation is appreciated, but not essential."
"Suggestions for improvement, eh?" said Vimes cheerfully, while behind A.E. Pessimle's chair Sergeant Littlebottom shut her eyes in dread.
"Jolly good. I've always been known for my cooperative attitude. I did mention about the Duke thing, did I?"
"But yes, Your Grace," said A.E. Pessimle primly. "Nevertheless, you are
Duke of Ankh-Morpork, and it would be inappropriate to address you in any other way. I would feel disrespectful.
I see.
And how should I address you, Mr. Pessimow? Said Vimes. Out of the corner of his eye he saw a floorboard on the other side of the room lift almost imperceptibly.
A.E. Pessimow will be quite acceptable, Your Grace, said the inspector.
The A standing for... Vimes said, taking his eyes off the board for a moment.
"'Just A, Your Grace,' said A.E. Pessimow patiently. "'A.E. Pessimow.'
"'You mean you weren't named, you were initialled?'
"'Just so, Your Grace,' said the little man calmly.
"'What are your